into a marriage that became an intellectual and political partnership that bound them in a whirlwind of experiences, public and private, that drew them closer with each passing year. In January 1954, King's coursework was completed, and he sought a steady income for his new family. He received an invitation to preach at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. 2 months later, the church offered him the position of pastor, with a salary of over $4,000, making him the highest-paid black minister in the city. He preached his first sermon as Dexter's full-time pastor in May, the same month as the Brown Supreme Court decision, and shortly before Malcolm X arrived in Harlem to preside over Temple No. 7. Not long after arriving in Montgomery, King found his professional trajectory altered by local activists and their struggle to end segregation on the city's buses. Rosa Parks, a 42-year-old NAACP organizer who had attended classes at the Radical Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, emerged as the symbol of quiet dissent against Jim Crow after her arrest for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger on December 1, 1955. Parks' arrest set the stage for a planned bus boycott, organized by some of Montgomery's leading labor and civil rights activists. The 381-day action thrust King into the national spotlight as the president and chief spokesperson for the Montgomery Improvement Association, MIA. King's election to the position had represented a compromise choice. As a relative newcomer to Montgomery, he had not had time to make the kind of political enemies that blocked the ascent of more well-known activists. Through the MIA, King learned enduring political and organizational lessons from seasoned activists more familiar with grassroots organizing for racial justice. Over the course of the boycott, he survived death threats, a house bombing, and arrests to emerge as a national civil rights leader, with a moral and political vision rooted as much in the social gospel and Christian faith as in the nation's founding documents. In the year leading up to the boycott, King developed a deep friendship with Ralph Abernathy, the charismatic black pastor of First Baptist Church. Abernathy was born in Alabama's Black Belt and was gifted with a pragmatic intelligence. He admired King's elite social background as much as King delighted in Abernathy's deep country roots. The two enjoyed a shared sense of humor, private jokes, and teasing in a way that made them more brothers than friends. Martin and Coretta welcomed their first child, Yolanda, called Yoki, weeks before the start of the boycott. The young husband and father briefly hesitated before diving into his role as chief spokesperson of a local movement that captured the national imagination. As MIA president and pastor of Dexter, King presided over twice-weekly mass meetings. There, he outlined a political philosophy arguing that the combined power of Christian love and nonviolent protest could challenge the evils of Jim Crow.
"One of the great glories of American democracy is that we have the right to protest for rights," King noted at one meeting.
The protests were organized by some of Montgomery's leading labor, women's, and civil rights activists and organizers. The Women's Political Council, led by Alabama State University English professor Joanne Robinson, used Parks' arrest to organize a citywide boycott its members had been discussing for several years. E.D. Nixon, past leader of Montgomery's NAACP, Pullman Porter, and proud member of A. Philip Randolph's Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, knew Parks and represented the defiant voice of black workers. The boycott relied on the deep well of knowledge such activists brought to organizing carpools, leafleting Montgomery's population of 50,000 black folk, and sustaining the racial solidarity that transcended the class tension within the MIA, where E.D. Nixon chafed at the increasing attention directed at the young Martin Luther King Jr. King's place at the forefront of the Montgomery bus boycott made him a lightning rod for threats from law enforcement and racial terrorists. On January 26, 1956, almost 2 months into the boycott, Montgomery police arrested King for speeding, a pretext designed to intimidate and disrupt the movement. King's brief incarceration had the opposite effect, galvanizing blacks who came to the city jail in a show of support that compelled his release that evening. 4 days later, racists bombed King's home. Coretta and Yoki escaped injury, but the violence directed at King and his family amplified the stakes of his involvement in the movement. Bayard Rustin's appearance in Montgomery less than a month after the bombing helped King make sense of the incomprehensible. A brilliant organizer, pacifist, and raconteur, Rustin had helped to mobilize some of the most effective interracial anti-racist movements of the 1940s, but his activism was overshadowed by a complicated personal history that included past ties to communists and a stint in jail as a conscientious objector. Rustin's political ambitions were also thwarted by his homosexuality, but he shared his experience as a professional organizer with King, exposing him to the intricacies of nonviolence as a way of life, which would disallow the use of armed bodyguards. Tall and courtly, with a shock of gray hair, Rustin would emerge in this pivotal moment as one of King's closest advisors. A Montgomery grand jury's decision to indict nearly 100 MIA members for violating an Alabama state law prohibiting boycotts brought the movement and King even more attention. He was ready for prime time. Journalists who flocked to Alabama found him to be a bracing combination of intelligence, erudition, and humility. The New York Times praised him as religious scholar and preacher, well-read in Kant and Hegel. In King, the black press in particular discovered a new hero. Alabama's modern Moses, proclaimed Jet magazine. It was the first time King appeared on the cover of a national black publication. The more legal troubles King incurred, the more his support, celebrity, and influence grew. On March 22, 1956, a judge found King guilty of leading an illegal boycott and sentenced him to serve 386 days in jail or pay court costs and a $500 fine. Released on an appeal bond, he went on the offensive, traveling to Brooklyn to speak at a fundraiser and announcing plans to help organize the black vote in Montgomery. Daddy King's ties to the sprawling National Baptist Convention, USA Inc., helped to bolster Martin's support among professional black preachers, their congregants, and the vast network of faith-based organizations. Racial justice activists who combined Christian faith with a fervent belief in the integration of America sought King out, including members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, FOR, and the Congress of Racial Equality, groups founded during the Second World War, when segregation's end seemed tantalizingly close amid wartime talk of interracial democracy and anti-fascism. King proved to be a dynamic and active listener, with an uncanny ability to absorb the ideas of a generation of veteran activists, including Rustin, Glenn Smiley, A.J. Musty, James Farmer, and the black feminist organizer Ella Baker. King's deft political instincts made him appealing to a wide group of, at times, competing interests. Supporters of Gandhi pointed out similarities between King and the anti-colonial leader. Over time, King embraced the portrait of himself as the American Gandhi. Conversely, in front of dedicated Baptists, he cast himself as a humble and observant Christian servant who preached against the evil of segregation. Journalists covering the boycott found King unique enough to be intriguing, and international reporters, in addition to the black press and correspondents from major dailies, began writing about King as his fame grew throughout 1956. The black press hailed him as the symbol of a dynamic movement, one that combined militancy, patriotism, and religious faith, sacrosanct qualities in Negro communities. The Baltimore Afro-American named King the top American of 1956, the first of many such honorifics that he would receive. By the spring of 1956, the Montgomery bus boycott emerged as one battleground in a larger movement for racial justice. King's travels outside of the city, giving major speeches, attending fundraising events, and sitting for interviews with an international contingent of journalists, galvanized support for the movement. Civil rights luminaries, most notably W.E.B. Du Bois, the first black Harvard Ph.D. NAACP organizer and scholar activist whose 1903 classic, The Souls of Black Folk, remained required reading among the African-American intelligentsia, corresponded with King. On the second anniversary of the Brown decision, King addressed an audience of 12,000. His sermon, The Death of Evil Upon the Seashore, made the struggle for black citizenship analogous to the Old Testament story of the Israelites escaping Egypt. He characterized Europe's colonization of Africa as one of history's worst tragedies.
The great struggle of the 20th century has been between these exploited masses questing for freedom and the colonial powers seeking to maintain their domination, King observed in a line that might have made Malcolm X proud.
That same evening, King spoke at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund dinner, describing events in Montgomery as the actions of a new Negro in the South who refused to live under Jim Crow's oppressive regime a moment longer.
The tension which we are witnessing in race relations in the South today, explained King, illustrated the revolutionary change in the Negro's evaluation of himself and his determination to struggle and sacrifice until the walls of injustice crumble.
King, without identifying himself as such, represented the generation of new Negroes he lauded. Civil rights elders recognized his efforts to distinguish the MIA and Montgomery's movement from an earlier generation of activists, even as he called their support. King's celebrity placed him and the MIA as fundraising competitors with the NAACP, whose legal defense fund covered the Montgomery movement, but received a large boost thanks to the infusion of new energy orchestrated by the young preacher. Montgomery City officials trafficked in legal threats, delay, and denial after a federal court panel ruled on June 4th against the city's segregated bus statutes. As the state of Alabama tried to prevent the inevitable, King narrated the story of the bus boycott to rapturous crowds across the nation. On June 27th, he delivered one of two keynotes at the NAACP convention in San Francisco, alongside the grizzled veteran A. Philip Randolph. King's speech emphasized nonviolence as a political method that effectively challenged racial segregation and white supremacy in love as the regulating ideal that allowed blacks to resist the evil of Jim Crow without bitterness or strife. The movement for black equality transcended race, King argued to an applauding crowd of 1,000 delegates.
The struggle is at bottom a tension between justice and injustice.
The movement to bring about full citizenship for black Americans had entered a new phase, one that linked racial equality to America's national destiny. For if democracy is to live, segregation must die. King's hectic schedule increasingly resembled that of an elected political leader, and on August 11th, he testified before the Platform and Resolutions Committee at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, in hopes of getting the party to officially endorse the Brown decision. He introduced himself modestly as the representative of Black Montgomery, but by that time, his reach extended both nationally and globally. Racial justice, King explained, meant not only a victory for 16 million Negroes, but a victory for justice and democracy. The Supreme Court's November ruling upholding the federal panel's Montgomery decision hastened Jim Crow's death. On December 3rd, King addressed the MIA's first annual Institute on Nonviolence and Social Change. The Institute sought to mobilize the energies unleashed in Montgomery on a national scale, offering seminars on nonviolent civil disobedience, voter registration, and civics education. In his speech, King acknowledged the many groups, organizations, and people who had allowed the boycott to flourish.
I would like to express my deepest appreciation to each of you for following my leadership, he explained, recognizing that, despite public shows of humility, his individual talents were integral to freedom's cause.
King touched upon global histories of colonialism and imperialism by noting that the vast majority of indigenous people living under oppressive regimes were colored and beginning to struggle for freedom. King compared domestic struggles for racial justice to anti-colonial movements sweeping across the world.
The old order is passing away, he said, and the new order is coming into being.
This new order required black leaders capable of occupying a creatively militant middle ground between what King called the extremes of hot-headedness and Uncle Tomism. On December 21st, Montgomery finally complied with the nation's highest court. King, surrounded by MIA colleagues and a caravan of reporters, climbed aboard a city bus for a hard-earned victory lap. King's world grew larger as events in Montgomery faded from the national spotlight. Shortly after his 28th birthday, he appeared on the cover of Time magazine, a striking drawing of a determinedly handsome King staring into the distance, silhouetted on the top right by a smaller sketch of him preaching, and on the bottom left by an image of blacks triumphantly entering a bus, powerfully depicted his growing national stature. On March 3rd, the New York Times Sunday edition profiled King in a story that noted his sharp mind, penchant for quoting Western philosophers and theologians, and extensive vocabulary. King had cultivated the persona of a religious scholar for the story. When the reporter visited him at home, Beethoven played in the background. But despite King's extensive education, blacks of all class backgrounds embraced him. "He knows how to speak to the PhDs and the no-Ds," locals in Montgomery were fond of saying. The coverage framed King as a salt-of-the-earth family man, an intellectually driven scholar and religious leader whose humility made ordinary black people embrace him as one of their own. Like Malcolm X, King fostered a deep interest in the potential for global affairs to inform domestic freedom struggles, especially in Africa, which he and Coretta visited for the first time in early March. In Ghana, formerly the Gold Coast, King observed the pomp and circumstance of the formal end of British colonialism. He marveled at Ghana's post-independence euphoria, enjoyed a private lunch with Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah, and chatted about American race relations with then-Vice President Richard Nixon. King arrived in Ghana in order to witness the birth of this new nation with my own eyes. He found strength in comparing African liberation movements with black freedom struggles back home. King, in contrast to Malcolm, viewed Ghanaian independence with a sense of optimism that made him believe that domestic freedom could be won through a nonviolent revolution. He personally marveled at the fact that Nkrumah dressed in the same cap and clothes he wore while in prison for sedition. Ghana offered King a lesson in the ultimate victory of sacrifice over violence, shared witness against injustice that could marshal triumphs that wars never could. After Ghana, King traveled to London to meet with C.L.R. James, the itinerant Trinidadian Marxist and author of The Black Jacobins, a classic account of the Haitian Revolution. James listened to King's description of the Montgomery struggle with keen interest, writing to friends afterward that nonviolence represented a technique of revolutionary struggle characteristic of our age. King's Ghanaian sojourn confirmed his status as the leader of an internationally recognized social movement. He started receiving letters from African students and Algerian revolutionaries. He returned to Alabama preaching a radical message of anti-colonialism, the birth of a new nation, a speech delivered from the pulpit of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church on the first Sunday in April, positioned Ghana's long journey into the community of free nations as a metaphor for the black freedom struggle. King framed a discussion of the travails of African countries since the transatlantic slave trade around the Book of Exodus, which found the prophet Moses leading his people out of bondage. As an appendage to the British Empire, the Gold Coast had experienced all of the injustices, all of the exploitation, all of the humiliation of colonial domination. King recounted how political oppression had been unable to diminish the thirst for freedom that remained humanity's birthright, and, in Ghana's case, became personified by Nkrumah, a native son educated at historically black Lincoln University, the University of Pennsylvania, and the London School of Economics. Like Malcolm X, King revered Nkrumah as one of history's most remarkable underdogs, a boy of humble origins who grew into an African leader capable of toppling an empire. Elected prime minister from a jail cell, Nkrumah had turned prison walls into a political kingdom.
"The road to freedom is difficult, but finally Ghana tells us that the forces of the universe are on the side of justice," observed King.
King's speech boldly proclaimed the coming end of Western imperialism and colonial domination as part of a divine plan of justice for oppressed peoples on both sides of the Atlantic. King retained his commitment to the principles of nonviolence, even as he offered a radical critique of global power relations and linked domestic civil rights struggles in America to anti-colonial insurgency around the world. King's visit to Ghana and Europe, where he marveled at the resilience of ordinary Africans and paused to consider the vastness of a rapidly crumbling British Empire, found him firmly in the camp of Black internationalism, a political philosophy shared by Malcolm X. Malcolm's thirst for radical Black dignity and King's quest for radical Black citizenship most comfortably met on the world stage. Both men recognized the systemic nature of racial oppression, one that transcended boundaries of nation-states to impact what King characterized as the world house, humanity's mutual interconnectedness. King's historical knowledge of Gandhi and Nkrumah and his personal experience in Montgomery, where he survived a litany of death threats and assassination attempts that only increased after the bus boycott, buoyed his faith in the political, philosophical, and strategic use of nonviolence, which he deployed as a shield against oppression both visible and unseen. Malcolm X might have found common ground with much of what King said in Montgomery that Sunday, especially King's visceral love of African people, the stinging indictment of colonialism and imperialism, and his professed belief that the world's Asian-African bloc would determine history's future. For Malcolm, however, defending Black lives against racial terror remained a sacred right of citizenship and a necessary tactic for a people still living in bondage almost a century after slavery's formal end. The press largely ignored the radical pronouncements in King's discussion of Ghana in favor of a more polished narrative of quietly determined moral leadership. In 1957, King publicly called on the federal government to robustly oppose racial segregation, an implicit rebuke of the Eisenhower administration's foot-dragging in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's virtually unenforced integration of public schools. While Malcolm X organized Muslim temples throughout the Northeast, Midwest, and strategic parts of the South and West, King spent the year searching for a vehicle to continue the stalled momentum of Montgomery. King's intellectual, political, and moral vision leaned toward a radical interpretation of social justice, but his personal instincts remained fundamentally cautious. Behind the scenes, he pushed for a private meeting with Eisenhower, something civil rights leaders had been trying to do since the president's first year in office. Bayard Rustin's assistance during the bus boycott proved to be invaluable, and he became a close friend and advisor to King. He introduced King to his vast network of social justice activists, some of whom would also form political associations with Malcolm X. Two of the most important would be Ella Baker, an NAACP organizer, labor activist, and feminist from North Carolina, who butted heads with the relatively inexperienced King and his largely male coterie of preachers, and Stanley Levison, a radical lawyer and social justice philanthropist who would find an easy rapport with the young civil rights leader and emerge as a trusted advisor. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, headed by King, administered by Baker, and with Rustin serving as chief counselor, became the vehicle for expanding Montgomery's success on a national scale. The SCLC's national agenda included registering millions of Black voters across the South and forming a national clearinghouse to provide direction, attention, and resources to local movements in Montgomery's aftermath. King's most visible effort after returning from Ghana revolved around the prayer pilgrimage for freedom at the Lincoln Memorial, an effort to shame and cajole the nation toward racial progress on the third anniversary of Brown. Planning for the event brought King further into the orbit of the NAACP executive Roy Wilkins, a key ally during the bus boycott, but a rival for claims of national leadership. Privately, Wilkins remained convinced that the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund offered the best avenue to end racial segregation, yet he recognized the power of the burgeoning social movement flourishing alongside King. A. Philip Randolph, the ex-socialist turned labor leader who adopted Rustin as an organizer after his own heart, viewed the event as a continuation of his 1941 March on Washington movement, a signature effort of the Double V campaigns to end racism at home and fascism abroad that pressured President Roosevelt into signing an executive order desegregating the military under the threat of thousands of Black men descending upon the nation's capital. Aspects of the pilgrimage seemed like a dress rehearsal for the 1963 March on Washington, with entertainment featuring prominent cultural supporters of the movement, such as singer Mahalia Jackson and entertainer and King confidant Harry Belafonte. King addressed the rally last, speaking to the biggest audience of his life. The moment, was a generational passing of the torch from A. Philip Randolph to the young king as the movement's crown prince. King's speech, "Give Us the Ballot," called for voting rights legislation as a means of promoting black citizenship, judging Democrats and Republicans alike as having betrayed the cause of justice. King described the president as silent and apathetic in the face of racial terror, and Congress as stagnant and hypocritical amid escalating national crises. The black movement required soul force to combat segregationist violence. Parts of the speech warned against rumblings of black supremacy and bitterness against racial oppression, anticipating King's public response to the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X's national rise. But still, shades of King's talk veered toward the militant, especially when he characterized the U.S. Congress as hypocritical, perhaps Malcolm X's favorite description of American democracy. In contrast to Malcolm's words of fire attacking white supremacy, though, King gently criticized white liberals as so bent on seeing all sides, they failed to commit to anything. The passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1957 in September was anticlimactic, falling far short of ending Jim Crow in public accommodations. The legislation created a Civil Rights Commission and granted the Justice Department the ability to file lawsuits against discriminatory voting registrars in the South, but it lacked broad enforcement powers and robust support from the president. The nation's first civil rights legislation since 1875, the new law provided hope for better days to come and burnished the reputation of then-Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson, a Texan with presidential ambitions who found enough common ground with liberals and conservatives to craft what one newspaper characterized as a masterpiece. Civil rights activists interpreted the law as merely an encouraging first step. As summer turned to fall, King publicly confronted American democracy's racial demons, which gripped the nation during a crisis at the Little Rock Central High School. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus's decision to use the National Guard to prevent the enrollment of 9 black students at the high school triggered a slow-motion crisis that produced some of the iconic images of the era, complete with angry mobs of white men, women, children, and teenagers screaming in unrepentant anger at the stoically dignified black faces attempting to reverse a century of racial apartheid. President Eisenhower spent 3 weeks negotiating a failed compromise before ordering the Army's 101st Airborne Division to restore order and peace to Little Rock. Fantastic images of American soldiers escorting 9 black students into the previously segregated school instantly became the stuff of legend, offering the movement its modern parallel to the Reconstruction era, the last time federal troops occupied the South. On September 25th, King sent a telegram praising Eisenhower for the stand you have taken to restore law and order in Little Rock, Arkansas. King's encouragement of federal intervention in local racial struggles would become the linchpin of his future political mobilizing, shaping the tenor of cooperation and conflict with the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. But for now, King was flailing, disconnected from the northern grassroots communities that galvanized Malcolm X, and unable to transform Montgomery's righteous discontent into a national movement. Instead, he primarily served as America's most celebrated conduit for discussing the contours of racial oppression in a shared language that resonated with black and white audiences. During a nationally televised October 27th interview on NBC's Look Here program, King spoke of racial oppression as a moral evil that required massive non-cooperation. He characterized nonviolence as the most powerful weapon against global regimes of political oppression and authoritarianism, and traced his own pilgrimage to nonviolence through his reading and personal experience in seminary. Nonviolence, King explained, required courage and fearlessness. The term passive resistance obscured, rather than illuminated, the strategy's profoundly disruptive impact on society. King's concept of nonviolence as dynamically active was in contrast with Malcolm X's withering description of the movement as simply organizing black victims to be brutalized by racial terrorists in the South. King psychologized the folkways of white supremacy, acknowledging how the civil rights movement negotiated a minefield that included the enduring paradox of liberal white guilt over racial discrimination juxtaposed against conservative white bitterness over blacks asserting their long-denied humanity. He ended the interview by optimistically detailing how the promise of shared economic prosperity, greater religious and civic courage, black political self-determination, international support for civil rights, and the hope of robust federal action made him confident that Jim Crow would soon end. Framing America's system of racial segregation as a moral evil allowed King to speak in the common biblical language of church-going citizens, even as his distillation of Gandhian principles of nonviolence combined with Christian ethics of love revealed the complex thinking of an intellectual. As Malcolm X ascended to the pinnacle of black radical militancy in Harlem, King became the face of national civil rights protest. King's success in Montgomery made him a larger-than-life symbol of the movement. A comic book, Martin Luther King and the Montgomery Story, was released, and King's ghostwritten by Alabama State Professor L.D. Reddick narrative of the boycott would be published in 1958 as Stride Toward Freedom. But on the ground, King's projects lacked momentum. Competitive tension between the SCLC and the NAACP hampered some of his organizing efforts. An additional problem was his failure to embrace the SCLC's new interim director, Ella Baker, whose organizing tenacity and brilliance should have made her indispensable to King, but did not. King's political compass on gender matters hewed closely to establish hierarchies that placed women, no matter how talented, in subordinate positions. King's leadership energized the national civil rights movement and placed the black church and faith leaders at the forefront of the struggle for racial justice in ways that reverberated across black politics. His time in Montgomery introduced him to veteran labor, peace, and civil rights activists, who found renewed inspiration in the bus boycott and King's embrace of Gandhian principles of nonviolence. His relationship with Baker, who had run the SCLC's Atlanta office for 3 years, might have helped him to better recognize the importance of collective, rather than top-down, decision-making and leadership. But, as a product of the black church's clearly established hierarchies, King took no such lesson. While he admired a measure of political militancy, he embraced traditional leadership roles that placed power in the hands of privileged men. In other words, he remained a work in progress. Baker pushed King to acknowledge black women in the movement as intellectual and political equals, challenging him to expand the scale of his vision and the depth of his personal commitment to freedom for all people. King, always uncomfortable with personal conflict, deflected these challenges by avoiding Baker and excluding her from his inner circle. His lack of professional chemistry with her was rooted in his reluctance to take seriously the organizing expertise of a veteran activist 25 years older than him. He found Baker's criticism of SCLC top-down leadership structure too harsh, and her distaste for charismatic preachers offensive. His personal sexism, imbibed at home, in the black church, and in the larger society, precluded him from acknowledging black women as more than political surrogates. On the 10th anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi's death, King published an editorial arguing that humanity faced a choice between nonviolence and nonexistence. He was confident in the ability of Christianity's love ethic to spur social transformation across whole societies, regions, nation-states, and, eventually, the entire world. He would begin by confronting Southern racial mores that viewed black subjugation as the divine right of whites, who blissfully attended segregated churches, wept at Billy Graham's religious crusades, and prayed to God to maintain a way of life based on black misery. King also took a month-long tour of India in early 1959, and the trip moved him closer to becoming the kind of leader Baker longed for. Bayard Rustin arranged for meetings with key associates of Gandhi, and King returned to America with amplified respect for the suffering of local justice movements. After leaving India, he visited the Middle East, where he toured Lebanon and Jerusalem. Brief stops in London and Paris during the trip gave King the opportunity to meet with Richard Wright, the radical black novelist and expatriate whose literary masterpiece, Native Son, inspired generations of radical African-American writers and activists. Over dinner, King and Wright developed a familial rapport. King marveled at the writer's abilities as a raconteur, which sparked a warm friendship that would be cut short by Wright's premature death the next year. 4 days after that meeting, King dined with Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister and a dashing international hero of anti-colonialism. Over 4 hours, they discussed Nehru's practical efforts to eliminate poverty and caste discrimination, and his role as head of state in a world buffeted by violence. Having never been invited to dinner at the White House, Nehru honored King as a visiting head of state. Locals followed suit in their embrace, especially India's marginalized class of untouchables, who greeted King as a brother in the South Indian state of Kerala. King's sojourn to India found him basking, like Malcolm X, in the burgeoning political strength of the Third World. King encountered India as both a faith leader and political mobilizer. The American Gandhi praised Mahatma in speeches and books for facilitating a practical strategy to institutionalize a vision of the beloved community based on Christian teachings of love, peace, and self-sacrifice. Politically, King took full advantage of his Third World moment, characterizing himself as a pilgrim, coming to pay homage to a nation liberated from colonial oppression against seemingly insurmountable odds. Before Malcolm X stepped foot in Africa, King proudly claimed the Third World as an integral part of a worldwide social justice movement. King narrated his trip in the July issue of Ebony Magazine, the popular monthly enjoyed by the black middle class. "My trip to the land of Gandhi," announced King as a global figure whose connection with the nonviolent movement's most sacred historical figure went beyond soaring rhetoric. Now he had been in Gandhi's homeland. King compared India's caste system to American Jim Crow. He claimed India enjoyed more racial progress than the United States, and contrasted Nehru's public opposition to discrimination with the lack of moral courage by America's political leaders. King's taste of the world further refined his civil rights activism and expanded his empathy for the poverty-stricken masses, whom he now personalized through his trip to India. Travel abroad introduced him to the ways in which problems of race, poverty, and violence flourished around the world, echoing the civil rights conflicts at home. The world stage bolstered King's personal conviction that a movement for achieving black citizenship could reshape not only American democracy, but human rights struggles that span the globe. He returned to America's domestic civil rights front more aware than ever of the movement's international dimensions. Chapter 3: The World Stage. In 1959, Malcolm X, like King, explored the international contours of the black freedom struggle. Malcolm's first trip abroad expanded his political vision, organizational ambitions, and intellectual yearnings. Touring parts of the Middle East gave him a new appreciation for the expansiveness of the struggle for black dignity. He identified with Muslims and the larger pan-Arab world through a shared religion and understood anti-colonial struggles as part of his own freedom quest. Malcolm's sojourn abroad also gave him the opportunity to flex new political muscles. He comfortably took on the role of both NOI surrogate and international diplomat, eager to negotiate stronger ties between the messenger and the larger Arab world. The messenger and his followers were sensitive to allegations that their religious practices fell outside the boundaries of Orthodox Islam, but as the Nation of Islam's financial resources grew, so did Elijah Muhammad's efforts to be considered a part of the global Islamic community. Muhammad began a correspondence with Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser by congratulating him on the successful Afro-Asian People's Solidarity Conference in Cairo that convened December 26, 1957 to January 1, 1958. This initiated a cordial relationship that resulted in the Egyptian government inviting Muhammad to make the Hajj to Mecca, an invitation that he delayed in accepting, opting to send Malcolm as his envoy instead. Malcolm applied for his first U.S. passport 1 week after turning 35. In the Middle East, he became a freelance diplomat who courted the heads of newly liberated Third World nations. Malcolm arrived in Cairo on Saturday, July 4, 1959. Like King's glorious reception in India, the Egyptian government received him as a visiting dignitary, housed him in an elegant hotel, and placed Vice President Anwar Sadat at his disposal. Malcolm's first encounter with the Arab world was eye-opening, as he fumbled through prayers with little knowledge of Arabic, but he conversed intently with diplomats, clerics, and official emissaries about the fight for racial justice in America, and he grew excited upon finding that the people in the Middle East reminded him of home. These kindred spirits pushed Malcolm to expand his political imagination. He encountered light-skinned and near-white Muslims who shared his thirst for the political liberation of all oppressed people. 99% of them Arabs would be Jim Crow in the United States of America, Malcolm noted. They would be right at home in Harlem. From Cairo, where a case of dysentery left him incapacitated for 3 days in his hotel room, Malcolm traveled to Saudi Arabia. The warm treatment he received from both light and dark-skinned people in Saudi Arabia proved to be transformative. "There is no color prejudice among Muslim," he wrote in a column published by the Pittsburgh Courier. "For Islam teaches that all mortals are equal and brothers." Malcolm reported back to the black press that Arabs and Africans were more concerned about the civil rights struggle in the United States than their own status right here in Africa. Malcolm used personal reportage to build and promote a pan-African solidarity between black Americans and the Middle East. In Sudan, from Khartoum's Grand Hotel, Malcolm reveled in the role of the radical statesman, praising intelligent Africans who questioned why millions of blacks lived without freedom, without public school rights, only to be relegated to slums, ghettos, and other social imprisonment in America, a nation that touted its democracy all over the world. He accepted the gracious hospitality of local officials during his 11-day stay in Khartoum. The prominence of dark-skinned officials, such as Egypt Sadat, impressed Malcolm, who came to better understand the nuances of racial identity outside of America. He discovered that light-skinned politicians in the Middle East could be just as radical as their darker-skinned counterparts. Tours of Cairo, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan convinced him that Africa is the new world in whose bright future Negroes are destined to play a key role. Malcolm's trip drew him closer to the world of countries battling for political autonomy outside of Western domination. His wish to feel the pulse of as many of the African masses as possible before returning home made him an eager student and careful observer. As he surveyed the breadth of U.S. global influence, Malcolm dared Americans to confront racial injustice back home. "Africans," Malcolm wrote from Sudan, "are asking why so many American Negroes suffer unemployment, bad housing, slum conditions, and poverty." He sought to wield the power of international opinion as a sword in the struggle for racial justice. "Here in Africa, the all-seeing eye of the African masses is upon America," he concluded. Malcolm returned to New York City on Wednesday, July 22, 1959, a few days after the airing of The Hate That Hate Produced, a nationally broadcast 5-part documentary series that turned the Nation of Islam into a genuine phenomenon. The documentary was the brainchild of Louis Lomax, one of Malcolm's favorite reporters, a savvy journalist who refused to let a 5-year prison stint derail his professional ambitions. Lomax parlayed his inside access with the Nation into a documentary hosted by local journalist Mike Wallace, who would make his name from the controversy generated by the film. The Hate That Hate Produced premiered over 5 consecutive nights, but it was such an immediate sensation that CBS rebroadcast it as a 1-hour special the day Malcolm returned from Africa. Wallace breathlessly narrated footage of the messenger and Malcolm speaking to thousands of followers in Washington, D.C. "Here you see their minister, Malcolm X, displaying 5 of the biggest Negro papers in America," observed Wallace. "Papers published in Los Angeles, New York, Pittsburgh, Detroit, and Newark, and Negro politicians, regardless of their private beliefs, respectfully listen when the leaders of the black supremacy movement speak." A one-sided indictment of the group, designed to scare white liberals, outrage conservatives, and shame the civil rights establishment, the documentary had the unintended consequence of turning Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad into folk heroes within the black community. Nonetheless, mainstream media and civil rights leaders would repeat the film's characterization of the Nation as black supremacists preaching racial hatred. 6 weeks later, Martin Luther King Jr. followed suit, describing the NOI as advocates of black supremacy. Malcolm's instincts for public relations inspired the nation to assume control of a narrative shaped by the white media, as civil rights leaders vilified the group by echoing the film's simple reverse racism thesis. The Messenger headlined a massive rally in Harlem. Over 6,000 supporters packed St. Nicholas Arena to hear Muhammad deliver a combative speech. He praised the nation as part of a global Islamic community, which Malcolm's recent trip to the Middle East had resoundingly solidified. The hate that hate produced had transported the NOI from the margins of the National Civil Rights Movement to its center. The nation's steadily increasing membership virtually exploded from 6,000 to over 50,000 by 1961. The footage of all-black rallies designed to frighten whites energized portions of the black community that had only dim memories of the New Negro and Marcus Garvey, reinvigorating a strand of black radicalism that had been pushed to the sidelines of the American political and cultural mainstream. But while the press attention spurred unprecedented growth for the nation, it also introduced new doubts, fears, and anxieties within the group's cloistered ranks. Skepticism and envy of Malcolm within the organization grew, as did rumors that he, and not Elijah Muhammad, exerted the most control. As the NOI flourished, Muhammad's genuine paternal love for Malcolm slowly curdled into deep suspicion and resentment. Martin Luther King Jr. confronted the controversy directly during an August 20th speech at the National Bar Association in Milwaukee. A week earlier, he had sent a telegram to President Eisenhower, unsuccessfully urging him to issue a proclamation in support of school integration ahead of Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's visit to the States. In Milwaukee, King claimed that Eisenhower was on the wrong side of history's sweeping momentum for racial justice, characterizing the White House as too silent and apathetic in the midst of an epic freedom movement.
"I fear that future historians will have to record that when America came to its most progressive moment of creative fulfillment in the area of human relations," said King, "it was temporarily held back by a chief executive who refused to make a strong, positive statement morally condemning segregation."
King condemned both major political parties in his speech, accusing Southern racists and right-wing Northerners of unleashing toxic, anti-democratic energies into the Democratic and Republican parties. King mockingly praised segregationists such as Mississippi Senator James Eastland because he airs his vicious prejudice all the time, in contrast with politicians who pretended to support black citizenship during election time, only to abandon black folk and democracy itself once in office. Near the end of the speech, without explicitly mentioning Malcolm X and the nation, King decried the rise of black hate groups.
"Black supremacy is as bad as white supremacy," he proclaimed,
providing a phrase that continued the simple analogy between the Klan and black Muslims. This allegation overwhelmed his pungent criticisms of the Eisenhower administration, the Washington political establishment, and American democratic culture. King had misinterpreted Malcolm's call for radical black dignity as simply the continuation of racial oppression, with black folk assuming the negative role historically adopted by whites. What King referred to as black supremacy, Malcolm defined as radical political self-determination, an affirming act that acknowledged the humanity long denied African Americans. Although King publicly repudiated the ideas of racial violence and separatism increasingly associated with the nation and Malcolm X, he never engaged with Malcolm directly. Instead, King's biggest adversary on the subject of black militancy came from a recent outcast from the NAACP. In the pages of the pacifist magazine Liberation, Robert F. Williams channeled Malcolm's call for self-defense against white supremacy in an essay titled, "Can Negroes Afford to Be Pacifists?" Williams turned a rash statement that "we must fight back" into a clarion call for black political action, arguing that nonviolent boycotts in Montgomery could not root out the evils that plagued Monroe, North Carolina, where he lived. Williams, a proud Marine who had enlisted the year the Supreme Court ordered school desegregation, noted that his own country taught him to fight, and that nowhere in the annals of history does the record show a people delivered from bondage by patience alone. Williams concluded his essay by accusing King of hypocritically supporting American violence during the Second World War as a moral good to defeat fascism, but preventing defenseless Negroes from doing the same at home. Williams took particular umbrage with King's July 17th address at the 50th annual NAACP convention, where delegates debated and affirmed Williams' suspension from the organization. King had also condemned him during a speech to an NAACP youth contingent that evening, but had praised black participation in the global struggle for democracy during the day, a contradiction the Monroe leader pounced on. Williams did characterize King as an effective leader in the civil rights struggle, but he contrasted the experiences of black people in rural hamlets like Monroe, where blacks confronted savage violence with the struggles of those whom King had led in Montgomery.
"There is more power in socially organized masses on the march," countered King, "than there is in guns in the hands of a few desperate men."
King blamed debates within the movement between nonviolence and self-defense on external forces who substituted token integration for the transformational power of fully integrating the nation's democratic institutions and public, civic, and social spaces. King's essay responding to Williams, The Social Organization of Nonviolence, urged blacks to place their bodies on the front lines of an enduring nonviolent struggle capable of ridding the world of segregation. To do so, he argued, blacks would need to stop fighting among themselves and innovate new, creative forms of protest. In his public fight with Williams, King confronted Malcolm through a proxy, a pattern that would continue with Malcolm regularly debating Bayard Rustin, one of King's closest advisors, over the next 3 years. At the end of the decade, King left Montgomery and Dexter Avenue Baptist Church to return home to Atlanta, where he fulfilled Daddy King's dreams by finally assuming co-pastorship of Ebenezer Baptist Church. Malcolm, meanwhile, responded to the ferment of publicity and energy surrounding his global travels by founding the weekly newspaper Muhammad Speaks in 1960. An immediate sensation, the newspaper featured penetrating editorials, reports, and analyses of the unfolding civil rights revolution. Malcolm hired seasoned black reporters and dedicated journalists who covered the fight for black equality at the local, regional, national, and global levels. With a circulation that would grow to over 500,000, Muhammad Speaks would document the rise of black power activism that overlapped with civil rights struggles at home and anti-colonial upheavals around the world. Aftermath of Birmingham, worldwide echoes of U.S. oppression blared a typical headline during the early 1960s. In 1960, Malcolm X was leading a black nationalist movement that critics, including the New York Times, characterized as racial extremism. That year, buoyed by national media coverage and Malcolm's exhaustive speaking schedule, the NOI made deeper inroads into New York City's political landscape. Malcolm and the nation led black nationalists across the five boroughs via mosques, small businesses, and well-attended religious rallies that served as de facto political events. They moved from competing with rival black nationalist sects for access to visiting African dignitaries to commanding the stage with political leaders such as Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah. The Nation of Islam's embrace of racial separatism and advocacy of self-defense turned them into a group perceived as both dangerous and exotic. Malcolm's rhetoric of racial solidarity against white supremacy found him superficially maintaining the nation's official policy against formal political involvement. The NOI preferred instead to build up a nation of dedicated followers whose economic resources, religious faith, and personal dignity, they hoped, would shield them from the hardships of Jim Crow racism. As white interest in the nation grew, so did the group's wish to shape the media narrative that surrounded it. They would do this most successfully through the founding of Muhammad Speaks, but the NOI also disallowed whites from attending Muslim religious service, and journalists had been barred from Elijah Muhammad's triumphant visit to Harlem the previous July. The NOI's popularity shifted political alliances in Harlem, turning Malcolm X and the group into power brokers, regularly consulted by black elected officials and religious and civic organizations. Other major civil rights groups, including the NAACP, remained distant but respectful. Malcolm's insistence on black dignity came alive when four black students from the historically black school, North Carolina A&T, staged a sit-in on February 1st to protest racial segregation at a Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. By peacefully sitting in the area reserved exclusively for white patrons, the students announced themselves as dissidents whose actions incited shock, controversy, and over time violence, arrests, and support. The sit-ins swelled over the following months. They started to include white activists, and they moved from North Carolina to other southern states, and then finally to the north, where interracial groups of students organized sympathy demonstrations. With the lunch counter sit-ins, direct confrontation against Jim Crow captured the national imagination. Although he remained skeptical of their steadfast belief in American democracy, Malcolm admired the boldness of the student activists. He alluded to the new Negro, black folk directly challenging white supremacy through demonstrations, pickets, and sit-ins, during a March 10th radio debate with journalist Barry Gray in New York. Malcolm and Gray parried over race, democracy, and social justice during the hour-long program. Malcolm identified himself as a black man despite complexion, noting that his fair skin, red hair, and freckles did not exclude him from a community he defined by membership and a shared history of oppression. "Radicals don't clap our hands and say hooray over the few blacks who've made it," observed Malcolm. "We're thinking of the masses." His critique of American democracy took center stage. He observed that anytime you have to make new bills or pass new bills to give voting privileges or give voting rights to approximately 20 million black people, then you can't just call these people citizens. For Malcolm, citizenship meant dignity, something new laws and legislation cannot possibly bestow. Malcolm's rhetoric matched the tenor of the times. Ella Baker, a longtime critic of Martin Luther King Jr., recognized the sit-ins as a long-awaited opportunity. Baker organized an Easter weekend meeting at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, aimed to harness the political energies unleashed by the student activists. Time with King had convinced Baker that the movement needed a grassroots leadership that wasn't enmeshed with middle-class preachers. The meeting attracted dozens of the most gifted and dedicated student organizers around the country, many of whom remained impressed by King, who helped to sponsor the event. Baker urged them to turn the insurgent sit-in demonstrations into a permanent organization, one unattached to any existing civil rights group, untethered to any pre-existing agenda, and unencumbered by top-down leadership. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was born from these deliberations. SNCC activists became soldiers on freedom's southern battlegrounds, practicing the tedious, dangerous, and unacknowledged work of organizing poor black sharecroppers in southwest Georgia, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, and throughout the South. But SNCC's reach also extended along both coasts, where friends of SNCC groups popped up to organize sympathy demonstrations, hold fundraising events, and help publicize the group's efforts nationally. SNCC's campus affiliates, especially Howard University's Nonviolent Action Group, became effective lobbying organizations, protesting for racial integration in the building trades, testifying before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and lending an edge of northern militancy to the group's southern roots. SNCC also attracted religious students enthralled by King's example. Alabama native John Lewis, South Carolina's brilliantly combative Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, Atlanta's cosmopolitan Brahmin Julian Bond, and New Yorker with Caribbean roots Stokely Carmichael all gravitated towards SNCC. Many of these activists would come to form close relationships with King. His friend, Vanderbilt University seminarian James Lawson, helped to train student activists based in Nashville on nonviolent tactics and philosophy in the months leading up to the sit-ins. Other SNCC members, most notably Carmichael, deeply admired Malcolm X's criticism of white supremacy and advocacy of black pride. Howard University represented the group within SNCC most comfortable with Malcolm's brand of black radical politics. Two competing tendencies, which roughly paralleled the public arguments and philosophies adopted by Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., emerged within SNCC. For many, especially already devout Christians raised in the black Southern Church, nonviolence became a spiritual philosophy, and they looked toward Gandhi for inspiration. Malcolm's insistence on black dignity, on the other hand, appealed to the sensibilities of activists who longed for bold action in the face of white supremacy. The more secular-minded SNCC members adopted nonviolence as a useful tactic, but argued for keeping all options open. King released a statement to reporters on April 15th, the first day of the conference at Shaw University, that characterized the sit-in movement as the latest chapter of a global struggle for dignity and freedom, and explained that the students were wielding the shield of nonviolent civil disobedience and mass protest as a weapon against racial subjugation. During the weekend in Raleigh, King discussed the rise of the student movement on NBC's Meet the Press. Moderator Ned Brooks identified King as the leader of a national movement for nonviolence that included the sit-in protests, the exact kind of suggestion that exasperated Baker and, over time, would disappoint some students. King applauded young people for showing the world the indignities and injustices blacks faced around the country. He pushed back against former President Harry Truman's assertion that private business had the right to choose whom to serve. He defended the concept of civil disobedience to the Round Table of Journalists, who questioned the morality of a movement that asked the federal government to enforce desegregation laws while trumpeting a right to civil disobedience. The direct action approach, argued King, sought to stir the conscience of the American public on behalf of both recently won civil rights victories and those freedoms that remained unwon. Malcolm responded to the fervor surrounding the sit-in demonstrations by organizing the Harlem Freedom Rally, an event whose political diversity reflected his continuing dreams of bringing a Bandung conference to Harlem. 4,000 people gathered on the last Saturday in May, on 7th Avenue and West 125th Street, to hear Malcolm headline a 6-hour program on the merits of racial solidarity. The grave racial crisis confronting America, Malcolm explained, required creating a diverse-thinking united front. He promised his full support for any fearless black leaders who will stand up and help the so-called American Negro get complete and immediate freedom. Roy Wilkins, citing previous commitments, failed to show, as did Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders invited to the event. But the Freedom Rally amplified Malcolm's role as a secular political leader, comfortable enough in his own religious truths to preach a transcendent political message directed at the black people of Harlem, the black people of America, and the black people all over this earth. Malcolm spent 1961 honing his speaking style for general audiences. He practiced introducing himself for his frequent radio appearances, often bypassing the host's canned remarks about reverse racism and black supremacy, in favor of a respectfully succinct introduction. I represent Mr. Elijah Muhammad, the spiritual head of the fastest growing group of Muslims in the Western Hemisphere. Malcolm enjoyed debating civil rights moderates and black intellectuals, whom he derisively referred to as professional Negroes. For Malcolm, such spokesmen were little more than puppets for the white man. He also relished publicly sparring with racial integrationists, and he participated in two high-profile debates that year, the first with Reverend William James, a Harlem pastor, on WMCA Radio, the same station that had carried his Barry Gray debate. The second, at Yale University Law School, featured NAACP Youth Secretary Herbert Wright. In both instances, Malcolm characterized the NOI's racial separatism as a philosophy based on strength, and the realization that America's practice of racial segregation represented the country's core principles, where civil rights activists, most notably King, argued that racial integration reflected the deepest aspirations of both whites and blacks, Malcolm objected. He defined segregation as the control of Negro bodies by whites, in contrast to separation, which was the voluntary promotion of self-determination for a black community in search of its own place in the world. That June, as the group prepared for a massive rally in the nation's capital headlined by the Messenger, Malcolm took key steps to politicize the nation in support of radical black dignity. In the run-up to the event, he compared the nation's organizing efforts to other civil rights groups, but with a twist. Muslims, he argued, wanted separation from white racism in the form of separate states within the United States so they could flourish and thrive, free from racial oppression. The impracticality of such a plan would prove irrelevant to the nation's most ardent supporters, who entered into an unspoken agreement, just as the followers of Marcus Garvey's Back to Africa plans had. That, however unlikely physical separation proved to be, the very idea represented the dream of black political autonomy and independence. Malcolm told reporters that thousands of non-Muslims planned to attend the D.C. rally. They felt tired of the slow pace of token integration, too intelligent to submit patiently to continued segregation, and fed up completely with the compromising attitude of Negro leaders, he said. He spread rumors in the black press that the messenger might go to the White House, backed by thousands of black folk hungry for bold leadership. The rally's theme, Separation or Death, highlighted the nation's self-promotion as an uncompromising group who willfully defied the racial integration promoted by civil rights groups in favor of self-determination. Despite the messenger's absence due to illness, the event attracted between 7,500 and 10,000, a crowd that demonstrated the NOI's growing national appeal. 3,000 Muslims from New York alone attended the event. Wallace Muhammad, one of the messenger's sons and a protege of Malcolm's, characterized Muslims as a peaceful people who can cause a great deal of trouble and needed to be taken seriously. "Any Negro trying to integrate is actually admitting his inferiority," said Malcolm, "because he is also admitting that he wants to become part of a superior society." Elijah Muhammad did make it to Harlem for his annual pilgrimage to the 369th Regiment Armory, where for the first time, whites were allowed entrance to hear the messenger speak. That same month, Malcolm attended a reception for Jaja Wachuku, the Speaker of the Nigerian House of Representatives, forging ties with African diplomats that would grow more intimate as the decade progressed. Fidel Castro's unexpected visit to Harlem in September 1961 confirmed Malcolm's new status. Black America's prosecuting attorney now shifted into a new role as the unofficial Prime Minister of African American Radicalism. Castro, the dynamic young lawyer turned revolutionary guerrilla, led the 1959 Cuban Revolution that deposed the American-backed regime of Fulgencio Batista. A vocal critic of Western-style democracies, capitalism, and imperialism, Castro alarmed American political leaders and anti-communist Cold Warriors, even as he galvanized supporters of anti-colonial movements around the world. Cuba inspired large swaths of the American left, including black radicals who toured the island, wrote articles about the new government's efforts to eliminate racial segregation, and touted Castro as an anti-racist leader bold enough to criticize America's Jim Crow policies and offer rhetorical support for liberation movements raging through Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Malcolm met Fidel Castro during a midnight session that included reporters, photographers, and an interpreter.
"I had always wanted to come to Harlem, but I was not sure what kind of welcome I would get," said Castro, holding court in his ninth-floor suite. "When I got news that I would be welcomed in Harlem, I was happy."
As photographers took pictures of the two leaders smiling and chatting amiably, Malcolm assured Castro that, "We in Harlem are not addicted to the propaganda they put out." The New York Amsterdam News gained exclusive access and carried a front-page story of the meeting, which showcased the ties between liberation struggles in Black America and in the rest of the world. During their brief stay at the Shelburne Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, the entire Cuban delegation alleged mistreatment that smacked of racism, while Shelburne's staff accused them of obnoxious behavior, unleashing recriminations that left all parties dissatisfied. The Cubans relocated to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. Castro, dressed in immaculately creased green fatigues, sat on the edge of a bed in his suite and invited Malcolm, wearing an overcoat, suit, and tie, to sit next to him. Malcolm greeted Castro, fully aware of the problems the delegation had had at the Shelburne. "Downtown for you, it was ice. Uptown, it is warm," Malcolm announced in an opening volley that Castro heartily embraced.
Ah, yes. We feel very warm here, he said in halting, broken English.
They discussed racial politics in America and around the world, with Castro remarking that Cuba accomplished in 18 months what you are still trying to do for 400 years. Castro touted the efforts to end racial discrimination in Cuba as evidence of the kind of international solidarity that Malcolm had been preaching since he first learned of the Bandung Conference.
We are all brothers, explained Cuba's young leader. The new nations and we in Latin America are all African Americans, he asserted, pointing to the 14 African countries newly recognized by the United Nations.
Malcolm and Castro bonded over shared reputations as unconventional political mavericks. The men both recognized the symbolic power of the Cuban delegation's visit to Harlem. Malcolm invited them to dine at the Nation of Islam's restaurant on 116th Street, but Castro declined the offer with his trademark sense of humor.
We want to cause as little trouble as possible, he replied. We will try to eat all our meals here in the hotel.
Malcolm departed with an invitation from Castro to visit Cuba and a renewed sense of the Black Freedom Movement's international possibilities. The New York Citizen Call featured a photo of a beaming Malcolm and Castro on its front cover. The New York Amsterdam News splashed a